We walk across the parking lot to our building and my boss goes, so obviously, Eric, that wasn't good. We don't have to dwell on what just happened because I was there, you were there. What are we going to do from here? My lifelong lesson, two things came out of that.
Hello and welcome to Salesforce Trails and Trials, where two Salesforce architects and special guests share their wins and woes so that you can learn with us.
Good afternoon, Eric. Great to see you.
Hey, good to see you too.
Yeah, it's great to connect with you today and with our listeners. We got a great show planned. How's the weather where you are?
Things are amazing as usual. I mean, maybe I'm just really grateful. It's above 70, which is great. It's a little cold at night, but you know, things are pretty sunny right now. So it's pretty awesome.
That's awesome. I love the in-between seasons down here in Southern California. You know, it's just the breeze, clear skies. So we're very sorry for those of you in the East Coast and elsewhere who are listening.
They've had it hot this week. My brother's in Boston and he was saying it was 92 and they got the beach and it's not the whole East Coast. I mean, there's people inland from the East Coast, but
it's true.
I'm sure it'll get hotter and it gets hotter where I live too. I mean, we'll be 105 here in a couple of weeks and I'm 20 miles from San Francisco. So maybe 30,
we can get to a 110 plus here. So everybody has their ups and downs, but,
It's our shoulder season right now.
Yes, it's nice. It's nice. All right. Well, let's move into what we learned lately, right? I'll go ahead and get started. I think.
Yeah, please do.
We talked about one great thing that Salesforce is offering is dynamic forms. And dynamic forms are a new way to lay out records that really can provide a priority of information that's really clear. So today you have a page layout and you essentially can organize that layout, but you have to show the whole layout.
Right.
Where dynamic forms enable us to say, you know what, if I only want to show 5 fields here and 7 fields on this other tab, I can do that. And I can make those conditional, lots of cool stuff, but it's only available for custom objects. Now, it's a lot of work to do it on standard object. I appreciate what Salesforce has done with custom objects, but there's a lot of demand for people who want this on their accounts, on their opportunities, on their contacts. Well, great news is the Good Five found out, right? And began reviewing the great folks over at Unofficial SF, which is essentially kind of Salesforce's almost like beta testing. It's the same people who work on product post Unofficial SF, and they kind of provide installable components there that people can test and validate before they become part of the core product. And so they now have, there's an article up on the Unofficial SF that'll be in the show notes, but it talks about now there's a flow component that you can use to bring dynamic forms to your standard objects right away. And it gives you this functionality because it's a little hard to make the argument to a client to say, you know what, you should go in this direction, but it'll only work for custom objects. Remember, in the Salesforce world, custom and standard objects live side by side. People don't even recognize what is one or the other. So it introduces this kind of, you know, bifurcation that's not even in the normal mindset or parlance of a typical customer. So this is a great way to get around it.
Yeah, it's been that way for, unfortunately, a long time at Salesforce. When we first invented standard objects, we wrote that code in a certain way. And as I understand it in the background, there is a class in Java called account, and it has account properties like hierarchy and things like that. And then we wrote a different class for contact and a different one for campaign. And then 5 years later, 2004, we invented custom objects, and that's a general class, but we all had all this knowledge of how classes should work by then that we made it this. It's somehow more advanced than all these standard objects. And so typically you'll see features come out for custom objects first when they're general features. And then later on, we have to go back and migrate that capability into the other classes for, do you think that's how I've heard it works? Have you heard anything different?
I actually haven't heard, much about this. I mean, it makes sense from a historical perspective, right? That, custom objects came later. So it's going to tap into all that innovation.
I think they all inherit from the S object class, but we always have to go back in and take whatever coolness we bring to custom objects and put it back into standard objects. So that's some under the cover stuff that I've heard at Dreamforce and other places. So anyways, I think that explains why that happened.
Sure. Well, it's great that they, I subscribe to, you know, those feature requests on the ideas board, right? So they have a request for each custom object. And so I see every day, I see comments coming through from people, right, stating their case. And it's a really, really high demand item. So I'd really recommend, right, listeners, please go follow that link, find this flow component. It's very simple to configure, and it gives you the capability so you can roll this out to your org sooner rather than later, because it really makes a big difference from where I've seen it be put into place.
So if it's in a flow, does that mean I can pull up the account page, the flow's on the page, it starts on the first page of the flow, it has a next button on it or a finish button? Like, how does it look on the page? Have you tried it yet? I haven't tried it yet.
Yeah, the way it looks on the page is instead of having your entire layout, for example, be in edit mode, mm-hmm, and then at the mm-hmm. bottom you have your save button. Mm-hmm. In this case, you have a certain segment of dynamic fields. Let's say there's 7 or 8 fields that you're looking at. Only those fields become part of your modify, and then you mm-hmm. just save that set of fields. So it does introduce some additional buttons depending on how you do the layout. Mm-hmm. So it just kind of does that particular section. But yeah, it's just very simple, very straightforward.
That sounds pretty cool. I think the only way to do like dynamic page layouts without this feature is to have a programmer create Lightning Web Components for each section of the page that are specific to what you want to be dynamic. Do you know of another way to make field visibility dynamic?
Well, that is one way. There is one way. It's a little bit of a convoluted workaround. So, you know, when you have a Lightning action, yes. you have a layout on that yes. Lightning action. Okay. Uh-huh. So you can actually go in and in your Lightning page. So let's say you create a Lightning action called, you know, let's say I'm on a contact, right? And I put in demographic info. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's what I want to show that on one particular secondary level, you know, navigation on my Lightning page. Mm-hmm. I can go create a Lightning action filter, like only include the fields that relate to demographics on my Lightning action page layout, but I'm actually mm-hmm. not going to use it in a button. I'm not mm-hmm. going to expose it on the layout.
Really?
I'm going to go to my Lightning page. I'm going to add what's called a related record component. And on that related record component, I can choose my Lightning action, and it'll uh-huh. only show those fields that are in the layout of my Lightning action. So I actually have clients who have used that as the workaround instead of this flow component for creating uh-huh. dynamic forms on standard objects.
Interesting. That does give you a flexibility, but then I go to like, oh my gosh, can you imagine being an admin coming in to support an account that you didn't know anything about?
Yeah, I don't recommend it.
And then you're like, wait, how do you manage page layouts?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, everything's in actions, dude. Everything's in actions. Just go find the action that, oh right. my God.
You're like, there's 15 actions on this object, but none of them are exposed as buttons. That's weird.
Yes. Okay. Interesting. That's yeah. one of those ways where you can do it. And there's a lot of flexibility here, but think about the long-term effects before you go do it, because maybe you shouldn't do it that way.
Mm-hmm. It's true. It's
interesting.
You know, sometimes you can, you know, if you think about one object and you're going to kind of pilot it with your team.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe you want to have it in a sandbox and you want to kind of help people get a picture and a vision of what this yeah. could do, especially around the, I would say the dynamic display and hiding. That's what's really powerful here is not only the ability to kind of organize the fields according to a priority of information that relates to your users, but the ability to say, I'm not even going to show this set of fields unless the account type is partner. That's a really highly requested feature. Mm-hmm. Most of the time people are building Lightning components to do that. Now it's very programmatic, right? It's very simple. You just do a filter on the component and you're mm-hmm. set.
And just to fill in the gaps there, there was always record type and page layout, but then you're stuck with that page layout for the record type. So yeah, this gives you, and people have been asking this for a long time. It's been on ideas for 5 years.
Yes,
and we've been piloting it. We've been trying it. I had a product manager show it to us 2 years ago and it looked really cool. And my first thought was though, this does give you flexibility, but this gives you enough rope to hang yourself too. Because now you have multiple ways to control visibility of stuff. And you just have to know as an admin, you have to stay up to date with the way things work in Salesforce, which mm-hmm. leads me, if you will, to my Please. Section where I was not up to date. So, you know, I learned the same way everybody else does here at Salesforce and with our customers. Trailhead, I read the release notes. There's no special training for technical architecture sales engineers to stay up on product, except that maybe I get the release notes a month before everybody else because I have access to pre-release stuff. I thought I knew what I was doing when it came to using VS Code. I learned how to do Apex debug logs 10 years ago. I learned how to use VS Code 5 years ago. At the time, also, there was the replay debugger that was part of sandboxes. And I learned how to do that in both Eclipse and VS Code. And I thought I knew what I was doing. And through basically volunteering to show a product manager where I thought the bottlenecks were on the dev process and being aware of what limitations I thought were there, the product manager did a really good job with UX design. We talked about last session about how when you're doing UX research, you never lead your audience. You always say, well, what would you do there?
Mm-hmm.
And why, mm-hmm. why is that? And what else would you expect? And you just a bunch of open-ended questions.
Mm-hmm.
As I was flailing is maybe not as bad as it really was, but as I was, you know, not finding the efficiencies that are built into VS Code, the product manager didn't tell me where to go look. Later on, I was looking something up 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, and I Googled something and I got Trailhead is the answer for what I was searching for. And I was really trying to get replay debugger working or whatever. And I found out there's a bunch of things that I didn't know existed that is probably 2 years old. Maybe you can tell me, but right from within VS Code, I can, you know, create an org if I wanted to, a scratch org, or I can, you know, authenticate to another dev environment. No big deal. Mm-hmm. Of course you can. I can turn on replay debugger and I can turn on logging in that environment for replay debugger without leaving VS Code. And I didn't know that. And I can also, of course, get my logs. But I was the whole replay debugger turn on or turning on logs. I thought you had to go into the Apex log setup menu because I've always done that. That was the quick and dirty way to go see what's happening in my Apex. And I just want to let everybody know, if you're as behind the times as I was on this particular topic, go take the Trailhead on Apex replay debugger and using VS Code and brush up on your skills, because it actually is pretty seamless to go from start project, start coding, test coding, see logs. And all you really need is a browser and VS Code, and you don't need to go in the setup menu to tune this stuff. So I'm a little bit embarrassed to say that, but I know there's many things that we all have thought we knew at one point, mm-hmm. 5 years ago, and then we've gotten a little, some cobwebs or some dust on what we know. And just a tangent that's a little bit related, I'm working with a Fortune 100 customer and they have some developers, and we were dipping into some Apex code and modifying classes, and they were pulling up the Lightning developer console to change the classes. And I didn't say anything because there were lots of people on the call, but if you only are using developer console and you're not comfortable with VS Code, please, 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 please go check out VS Code. It makes the experience better. It's got a black background. It's got colored text. it's got little foldy code collapsers. If you want to collapse a whole if statement out of the way because you know it's good, you can do that. You can, of course, set your breakpoints. There's just a whole bunch of things you can do in VS Code. It's just a much more pleasant experience. And then there's a whole bunch coming. I'm going to talk about what I'm excited about as well later on today, as some more VS Code stuff. But just my tip is, I learned something lately, and it was that I was rusty on VS Code and all that it offers.
That's good. And I'd say even for someone like myself, I don't consider myself a developer anymore, though I use VS Code, right? Like the ability to go and get a page, if I wanted to review a class or any kind of metadata component, just to go directly to the org and go get it and modify it and then commit it back to the sandbox without having to go through a DevOps process for something, simple like that. The ability to, have my source code management tool right there. So if I want to take what I've done and commit it to, Subversion or to GitHub or whatever it might be, I find that helpful. And honestly, even sometimes I don't like opening up CSV files in my spreadsheet tool, because you run the risk of unforeseen data transformation. Like anybody who's ever had zip codes in their column, and all of a sudden the leading zeros are just removed.
Poor because, East Coast people. I
exactly.
Wonder how often they're so focused. It's the Northeast. It's Boston, it's Massachusetts, all the zero two somethings.
Totally, right? All those leading zeros get removed and now my data is bad. So I will open up my CSV files inside VS Code.
I love it.
To look for something. And so there's little plugins that, for example, will color each column. So when I'm like 400 rows down and I don't see my headers anymore, but I know it was red. So all I do is I look for the red value in my row and I know it's row 4.
So
there's a lot of really helpful things, code completion, there's all kinds of fun stuff in VS Code, and it's an open source product. So it's being contributed. There's lots of contributions being being made. And at least components of it are open source that are being added to it all the time. So I'm a big fan, even if I'm not a hardcore developer. I just think it offers, it's almost like, in my opinion, it's like a decoder ring, right? Kind of an intermediary product that I can solve. I got to get to Z and I'm at A, and I got to get through D, E, and F to get there. And VS Code is like that Swiss Army knife, if you will, to take me there sometimes.
Cool. I love it.
Awesome. Well, great recommendation. And listen, a note on your willingness to be vulnerable, right, is a model for us all. The more we know, even if we're a distinguished technical architect, there's always something more to learn. And it is a great posture for all of us to have, that no matter what kind of competence we have in a particular area, there's always a different perspective. There's always a new use case, a new application, something coming in. And so it just exposes the more that we have the opportunity to learn.
Yeah. And just, if I can say one more thing, I'm working with another big customer right now. They've been customers for 10 plus years. They've had some issues with inefficient code and resource hogging code that's in Salesforce. And while we publish the best practices on what you should do in Apex, not everybody who's new or who's come around lately, maybe they learned Salesforce on the job and they were Java programmers and they just picked it up. Until recently, well, let's just say now, there are actually great super badges on Trailhead for Apex development. And so it just, like, you may know these things, but given 3 releases a year for the past, whatever, 20 years, I'm pretty sure there's something there you don't know. And there's something there I don't know. So go check out, like, if you think you know Apex well, go do the super badge, test through all those things. I promise you'll learn things that you were like, whoa, I did not know that. And you'll have great party discussion topics.
Right. Well, and you'll be a leader among, in those meetings, and you'll be leveraging the most innovative path to get the job done. Because Salesforce is really good about being backwards compatible, although you don't want to lead with the backward compatible method to get things done. Mm-hmm. You want to lead with the most modern, up-to-date, way to get things done.
Yep.
Very cool. All right. Well, let's move to, this. It's a kind of a modified segment. We've kind of talked about just one small thing and the consequences it could have, looking to be a warning for others. Right. But now we're going to talk about one small thing that did have big consequences from our kind of previous world. And so why don't you start? I think you had a very unique example.
So, I don't live in Salesforce implementation land. I live in Salesforce pre-sales explaining the product, but I used to be an IT consultant. And so my just one small thing that did have big consequences is a life lesson of being a consultant and a programmer and a developer in IT that I thought I'd just share, because maybe it'll help you understand something too. Back in the day, I worked for Accenture and I was working for a customer, and my job was to augment their IT department as a programmer. And I was building an integration between their website and their backend file storage product. And I had a UAT date that I had to meet. I was going to demo the product to the user group. And I was the only developer. It was just a one-man project. And I had a bug. And I was stuck on that bug on Monday. And I had the UAT on Thursday. And my boss kept coming to me and saying, "How's it going, Eric?" I'm on Monday. Tuesday, "It's good. It's good. It actually looks really good. Everything's working except for this bug." Tuesday, Wednesday, "Eric, UAT's tomorrow. How's that going to work?" I said, "It should be good. It's just this one bug. I can't figure it out. Everything else is working. It's just this one thing." I'm 25, 26 probably. And I'm still in this mode of being a consultant where I'm not super client facing. I'm more sort of somebody they keep in the back and they do their development, but I'm just branching out into the ability to make presentations and realizing lesson number one that Accenture always taught us was perception is reality. It doesn't matter what you thought. It's what the client perceived. That's what we want to control is Accenture. We want to always make sure the perception is correct, not that you thought you were saying the right thing. That doesn't count. So that was one thing. The second thing is we get to Thursday and I go to the UAT and I go over with my boss and I give the demo, and a bug pops up in the middle of the demo, some error or something. And I said, my presentation was, "And I got a little problem right here. I'm still working on it, but I want to show you where we were." I thought it was treating it more like a checkpoint than some kind of milestone. And the customer was not happy. There's like 8 people in the room. It's the head of vice president of customer service who's waiting for this feature to be rolled out in their CRM instance or whatever it was. And they're not happy. They're saying things, "Well, if this is the quality of, code that Accenture delivers or that Eric delivers, this is a I'm not sure about this. And Accenture is expensive. You know, I don't mean that. Like, it's, you pay a lot of money. They have experts around the world, but you're paying somebody hourly to more than you would pay, you know, one of your own employees because they're consulting. So we go out, we leave the building, we walk across the parking lot to our building, and my boss goes, so obviously, Eric, that wasn't good. We don't have to dwell on what just happened because I was there, you were there. What are we going to do from here? What do you need to get this done? Let's like re-envision what the project plan is, figure out what we need to do, who do we need to talk to, and how do we solve it from here? My lifelong lesson, two things came out of that. One is I wasn't communicating my risk to my boss properly before that, before the meeting. I was saying it should be good, but
if it's not,
I know. I and my boss, if he'd heard things differently, you know, I may not be able to get it working by Thursday. He could have fixed it. Mm-hmm. But my boss was trusting me to raise the severity or express the severity of the issue so that he could act on it, because he had the power to do it, but we just were not communicating right. So this happens all the time when I hear people say, my boss didn't understand me. My conclusion is you didn't say it right. Mm-hmm. So if you're trying to get something done and your boss is not responding, take it back to you and align it with what does your boss need to hear? What's your framework? The second lesson is, go ahead, comment.
Well, and then just validating understanding, right? Well, however you want to express it, validate, hey, what did you understand from that? Did you, you know, what did you think about the risk? What did you think about the potential, right?
Yeah. And the second thing was things go wrong in travel. You miss planes, no dinner reservation, you know, your daughter breaks her arm. And what are you going to do about it? Are you going to look at the last period and drone on about what we should have done different, or just go like, okay, well, this is where we are. Where are we going to go into the future? And I'm very much the latter. And the only downside is I don't dwell on the pain. So sometimes I don't learn the lesson because I'm always, it always works out. I'm always able to move into the next thing and I move forward. But I think if I focused on the pain of what went wrong, I might learn my lessons a little bit better, but that's, I guess I don't like doing that. I don't like to dwell on the pain. So anyways, my second life lesson is where you are, where you are. Let's move forward.
Well, I think that's a reason why ever since we met at Dreamforce in 2004, that we have stayed in touch, because I'm similar, right? It's about the path forward and we do our best to avoid those situations, you know, but just, but basically admiring or describing the problem, right? You have a kind of a minimum set of that needs to happen there to be able to move forward, but then getting on to moving forward is important.
Yes.
For sure.
Yes.
You know, well, it's well, one, I think it's a great example there. What I heard is also that that was a real point of potential conflict between you and your manager, you know, like there's a lot of people who, depending on how the manager handles that, they're done. Like, hey, I'm out of here. I don't get paid enough to deal with this, you know? And it's a really, it was a really good, whoever that was, right? They took that in stride and they leveraged it as a growth point. And you are a different person today, still, right? In the same, you're in the same industry, you're in the same consulting kind of mindset. And it was a really good example of how to handle a situation like that without sacrificing the relationship or the potential of that person to make it right. Right. Because eventually you did get around the bug and the customer got what they needed. And that's what's important, is that resiliency and staying committed. So well done. And I hope many people learn from that, both as managers and as those who, you know, want to raise those risks to managers and maybe not be sugarcoating it, be, you know, salt coating it and being like, you know what, this could be really sour. I'm hoping it's not, but let's plan for the worst and hope for the best, you know? So mine is, mine is specifically related to Salesforce. I was working for a significant partner of Salesforce on a product, and essentially it was a big team. And this team was really geographically spread out, right? So we had teams in India, in the Philippines, in multiple time zones in the US, and we're all collaborating, but you know, we're not working the same hours. And so there's kind of limited time overlap. So we kind of meet on these scrum calls together and then go off and do our various, you know, some people would end their day, some people would begin their day. So there was one instance where at that time, DevOps wasn't so mature, right? It was a little bit of effort to kind of get the, you know, migration toolkit up and like extract your metadata and like do all of that. So it was pretty common to kind of keep the source of truth as it relates to your Salesforce metadata, your configuration, Apex, Visual Force, et cetera, to keep it in a dev org or in a sandbox. Like that was the source of truth. It wasn't in the repository. It was in the org, right?
Yeah.
So there was an instance where we needed to move off, you know, there was kind of an object that needed to be removed because it was conflicting with one of the, one of the objects that was coming in with this product that was kind of being built. It wasn't fully namespaced and everything yet. It was kind of in a beta stage. And we needed to remove that object to make room for the next one. And that object had a couple things, you know, like we talked about the shadow index. We can't delete the object because, you know, there's a few visual force spaces that reference it. There's a few Apex classes that reference it. So the simple question came up, hey guys, so we got these dependencies. Here they are, a list of file names. Okay. What should we do with these? And some various conversation happens. And basically they're like, well, we should just remove them. Okay. So we double check. Are you sure you want me to just delete these? Right. Like, you know, people have copies of them on their local machine maybe, or just in case. Like I said, we didn't have DevOps to be able to go to Gearset, Capado, and just push a button and back up that metadata and see like, okay, we're good, right? Mm-hmm. So we just kind of said, okay. And so they said, yes, go delete those files. All right. So we did, right? So, I mean, it's pretty easy in setup, right? You got sysadmin, you go in, press delete in that sandbox on that Apex class. You press delete on that Visual Force page.
All cleaned up.
All cleaned up. And there's no recycle. There's no recycle bin in the org, right? Only objects and fields have a 2-week, right. You know, right. Everything else is like poof. Yeah. And so 2 days later, we get on a call and the team is really stressed. And they're like, hey, guys, does anyone know where this, you know, these two Visual Force pages and these two Apex classes went? And we're like, yeah, you know, ABC project manager had us delete those. And they're like, oh, that's gonna take a week to rebuild, you know, across two people. And so, you know, it kind of comes out that it was about over $20,000 worth of effort. And it caused the timeline to slip by a week and some other cascading, you know, dependencies that were waiting for that and were blocked. It was a big deal. So it's a small thing, right? I mean, it's like four mouse clicks. Delete, yes.
You double checked. Yes. You double checked.
I double checked. And ultimately, yeah, I mean, I had it in writing. I mean, so that was for me. I mean, I want to do kind of CYA on that, right? So I had it in writing that like, these are the file names and you reviewed them and you want us to delete them. Okay. Mm. And so, yeah, I mean, it didn't come back on me, but I just felt bad for the project. You know,
sure.
And it just shows like deleting something, there's no recycle bin, there's no recovering that. And it really, you know, from the customer's perspective, they heard about this. They didn't know the exact reason, but what they heard was that, you know, there's going to be some work, the timeline is slipping and, you know, it's kind of a lose-lose. Like if you don't tell them that much information, they're like, well, why did the schedule move and whatever. And if you do, then they're like, you know, so both instances, it kind of dilutes their confidence in you. So yeah. it was a small thing and it had a really big consequence. And I just think that that can be extrapolated across lots of areas in Salesforce, right? So lightning processes, complex workflow process, you know, like flows, these are all areas where there might be very significant formula fields. There might be very significant formulas and things that have been done and there are no recycle bin or better yet.
I mean, and this is, that's totally true. Do you know of another enterprise system that has a recycle bin? Can you undo changes in any
other? I mean, it basically just trusts you that like, dude, if you're in here, you have the keys and this
you are the administrator.
Administrator. Yes. you are the boss of this environment. And it's true. And it just, you know, sidebar, why if you're an org and you haven't had the political battle of not giving sysadmin profiles to your users, today is the day. Because the potential of them accidentally going into setup, looking around and deleting things is really high and there's no getting it back. So it's really, really important, you know, and we don't want one small thing to have such a big impact on your project.
Yeah, I know you, going back 3 or 4 years, I saw you at Dreamforce and we talked about, you were speaking on the importance of source code control. And maybe this was around that time. I don't know if it's related or you were just an endorser.
This was in 2014, very early as I was advocating for this.
That's when it was probably.
That's right.
And I remember saying at the time, you know, the ways to break Salesforce are not straightforward. You know, you can overcode it. You can design queries that run for a long time, but generally you're not going to break your instance. The only ways you can really break an instance is to do a massive overwrite of your data. There's no undo for overwrites. There's undo for deletes. And then, you know, you could roll things into production, overwrite some code. Again, an overwrite, there's no undo for an overwrite of code, or in this case, a deletion. So somewhere you need to be taking care of your backups, backup your data, and also back up your metadata, and do that somewhere. Like, if there's something we don't talk about enough, it's probably that. And this is your message probably back in 2014. It's what I tell my customers, just to make sure they've got something like that going on. And for anybody who's listening, if you haven't lately, go spin up an empty dev sandbox and take a snapshot of your environment if you don't have source code control, and just keep it off to the side and refresh it every once in a while, just so you can help somebody roll back someday. You can be the savior. And then, you know, if you're not doing data backups,
it's like a safe deposit box. You know, it's like a safe deposit box for your config, you know? It's and you get it's a good point. And yeah, the biggest point I was making back in 2014, right? The session was called Reducing Risk with Source Code Management, was, you know, one, just highlighting that most problems in IT space in general, not just with Salesforce, but like most hacks and other things, they all come from inside, not from outside, right? So
what do you mean?
You know, someone gets fired and they want to go, do some damage before they leave, right? And they happen to be a sysadmin, you know? And, you know, I hope it never happens, but it happens. So, so the point I was trying to make was that this isn't for developers. This is for everyone, right? Like your account page, your opportunity layout, your automation on opportunity, that's all IP that is your business secret sauce and how you serve your customers and how you have such an efficient, you know, operation. It should be protected like it was your software product.
Yeah. Good. All right.
Awesome.
That was a big one.
That was a big one.
I'm glad you had that CYA email in writing.
Me too. Yeah, I'm still friends with everybody who we went through that whole ordeal with. So
there was a bonding event.
Right, exactly. So let's talk about tools of the trail. So another new segment where we highlight some of the tools that we use that you can take advantage of that kind of make our work much more enjoyable and much more productive. So Eric, why don't you start? Because you highlighted earlier, gave us a preview and a teaser.
Sure. So, you know, when we were talking about this new topic, I rattled off four or five tools. I just want to make sure, based on a recent experience I've been using, I've seen people not using enough. One of them was VS Code. I talked about how this consultant or IT person from one of my large customers who uses a lot of Salesforce was not using VS Code or an IDE to do their code editing. And so my tools of the trade is VS Code. It's free. Go download it. It's all set up for you to connect to your Salesforce environment. You just authorize an org. You want to learn the control shift P command once you're in there, because it's going to bring up the menu of all the SFDX commands. It's got a tool that wasn't there originally. It's called the org browser. And that's where you can go look at all the metadata for the org, show me all the objects, show me all the fields, show me the flows, show me the, you know, classes, triggers, and whatever. You go pick it visually. There's a menu, open up triggers. You see the 20 triggers. You click on the trigger and you go on the right, you click on the download button, and it just drops the trigger code right into the right folder inside your Salesforce project.
Nice.
And you can just hit it. You do your changes, you test it, or you push it back up to production. You right click on the trigger, you click deploy the source to code, it pushes it back up to your org, and you go through your testing process. So just make sure you know about like VS Code and the ways that it can work. What's coming also, well, another things that have been there for a while, but just to highlight it, you can do SQL queries from VS Code.
Yeah,
you
write really out
the
useful
SQL statement, and then you just highlight it, right-click it, and say, execute SQL with the code that's highlighted. You can also highlight multiple lines of code and execute anonymous. So if you want to run it and have it, you know, do a system debug statement or do whatever, you can do it right from within the UI there without even going over to, I mean, it's a feature that's part of developer console, but it's also part of VS Code. And then I can tell you there's far more you can do if you're developing Lightning components. You can test locally with Lightning components. We're working on a forthcoming feature called functions, where you're going to be able to write Java or JavaScript code and have it run basically asynchronously without limits. But to get that, to test that code, you can actually write it in VS Code, and then you'll be able to test it against locally, using your local node server or Java server. So it's something that, you know, if you're not using already and you work in triggers, Apex classes, or Visual Force or Lightning, you know, there's a world that's better than developer console, and you just need to install it.
No, it's good. And a couple other esoteric use cases for VS Code. So I've shared a couple already. It's a great product, but let's say something like custom metadata. Mm-hmm. So custom metadata, right, allows you to kind of have your own little custom object, but that also has data that is kind of protected, right? You don't need to report on it necessarily. You just want it to be protected in the setup area.
It's like settings that you can reference.
Yeah, for your settings app. Or preferences. I use it a lot, for example, when you have an integration and there are certain static values in that integration that are kind of always mm-hmm. true. Mm-hmm. You want to, instead of putting those in an object, I don't need more than one record, and I don't want people to include it in reports or lookups, and right. I don't want people to modify it. So I put it as custom metadata. Well, you can pull that custom metadata down as a file into VS Code. And when you want to change some of the values, you just go find the element in the simple XML, you change the value and you deploy it back. Very simple. And it's another great use for VS Code, right? Because it's just like you're modifying a text file to get it done, right? You can also do it through the UI of Salesforce, of course, but it's a great way, especially if you have multiple ones, you're doing find and replace, you want to, you know, archive it, all that kind of stuff. So very useful. And I did put, we will have a link in the show notes. VS Code is an open source product that's collaboratively mm-hmm. developed with Microsoft. Mm-hmm. And so for those of you on the higher end, or even if there's something in VS Code that you wish was there, there's actually a process where you can make those feature requests. And it's great. Just like Salesforce, you have the idea exchange and you can ask for things that get voted on. Same thing with VS Code. You can go and ask the developer community, hey, we'd love to see this. And right, you may find it coming back to you for the benefit of us all. So
awesome.
Nicely done. Well,
what about you?
What I want to share is we've been using Jira for a long time for our internal kind of backlog and roadmap management, you know, as far as issues, mm-hmm. stories, and all of that. And so, you know, Jira revamped all of their UI like over the last 6 months or a year and kind of changed the way their product works, which is super cool. For us, it kind of went a little bit out of where our sweet spot is. And so we started looking around for different tools, and there's a lot out there these days. You know, there's Asana and Trello and some of these other tools. And so we found one that's actually based here in Irvine. It's called ClickUp, and we've been really happy with it. And I think the what I like about it is that it found a way to kind of answer the different, you know, if you think about a project, people, if you go to five different people and you said, how do you like to manage a project? You'll probably have like 10 different ways, you know, like, oh, I like to use Gantt charts, or, you know, I like Kanban. A calendar, or I like Kanban. Yeah. Exactly. I like a list, you know, and, mm-hmm. and I like to see a timeline view, just, you know, and I like to make sure I have dependencies noted, and, you know, there's all kinds of ways. And, sometimes people will say, well, you know, I like to be able to see things, you know, at a much higher level and then, or more granular and whatever, right? So we all know from chatter, it's great to have the ability to communicate on top of a record. So I can kind of keep that thread in the, uh-huh. exactly. So ClickUp allows us to have an activity view within every single task. So very much like Jira, right? Where I can have all my conversation, right? With the customer, myself, my team, all in line on that particular item. Now, here's what's cool. Let's say I want to send an email to Eric about this particular task, but I want to make sure it's in the history. This is a really neat innovation from ClickUp. So like we know with Salesforce, remember they used to have the email to Salesforce, you'd put in the BCC and you'd have to go file it. Well, ClickUp has this little feature. When you go to the activity, you can have like have a post, or you can connect your email account. Like for example, we use Google Mail. Mm-hmm. So you can connect your Google Mail account and I can send an email directly from ClickUp in my little thread. It logs it just like Salesforce would, right? It logs it to my thread on top of that task, sends it out via my Gmail account. So it inherits everything that the Gmail send would do. And, but I have it in my task, which is really fun. So now email, which is usually kind of the part of the process, it's in another app. It's like totally absent from the thread, you know?
Right. Because why would you unite the two? Yeah.
Right. Well, I think the need as far as like, there's a lot of conversation in email that happens related to this task. It would be nice if it was here, but just the means by which to do it, who's going to copy and paste every time they email? It's like silly.
Right.
So in this case, it's really cool because they allow you to just compose that email right from there, have it go just like it was sent from Gmail, but yet it's now part of the thread. And it's a really neat innovation. And going back to the views, so whether I like to see list or calendar or Gantt or timeline, or, you know, I can actually have all of those at the same time. Mm-hmm. They have a really simple way, almost like with list views, they have a really simple way for me to just switch views, and the items that have dates show up on the calendar. The items that have indicated dependencies show up on the Gantt chart, right? So I can almost say, you know what? The whole project is agile, but this particular section with integrations, we're going to run as waterfall and we're going to Gantt this guy. So I can now take those 17 tasks within my larger project plan, and those are on the Gantt because it matters. The rest of them on the Kanban board, on the timeline, those with dates are on the calendar. And it doesn't have to be an all or nothing thing, which is what I've experienced prior.
It's so flexible. That's cool.
Exactly. It's so flexible. I've really been pleased with how well it's
worked. Using it.
I've only been using it probably for 2 months.
Okay.
Yeah. That's so good. And it had an import tool from Jira and Asana. You can just import everything and it comes all in and you just organize it and you're ready to go. So we were up and running within a day. So I'm really pleased with it. And the final thing I'll say is one thing that has bothered me with Jira, for example, is if I just wanted to have Eric come in as an observer. You know, he's an executive. I want to make sure he's in the loop. I want to have another guest to make sure she can come in and contribute. With Jira, I have to like fully license them, even though they have a very limited role. With ClickUp, I can provide guests and I can provide read-only guests. And it's very easy. And cool. I can do it unlimited, right? Yeah. It doesn't cost me anything more to be able to share one list to a particular person. You know, I can assign tasks to more than one person. I can include them in more than one list. I mean, like I said, it's really flexible, but yet very clear. And, you know, you mentioned having a dark layout. They do a really good job of having a dark layout. That's popular for the, you know, the consultants and developers among us. Right. So I've been really pleased with ClickUp for us. And I just want to recommend that as a great tool to trail managing your roadmap and your backlog and keeping your customers, you know, and your partners and others really in the loop and not having meetings about where are we, but having meetings about how are we going to move forward. It really enables that.
Cool. I love it. I'm excited. You're excited about it. That sounds like a cool tool.
Yeah, it's fun. Good stuff. Well, let's move on. We got a few more minutes here. Let's talk about what we're excited about, right? What's noteworthy that's inspired you lately?
Sure. Mine was non-Salesforce topic. I was very intrigued by this story I listened to on a podcast called Radiolab, and it's called something like The Dirtiest Drug or something like that. And it's actually the story of a drug called rapamycin that comes from the dirt of Easter Island, or what's called Rapa Nui. And you can go listen to a podcast. It's about 40 minutes long. And it's about this, the son of the scientist who discovered it and how it went from this drug that people thought was a throwaway to actually being maybe the most important drug to prevent immune systems from rejecting transplants, aortic stents, things like that. And it had to go through this whole, clinical trial process in the 80s. It was working wonders. And then it may have even given the doctor who invented it, some extra time on his life because he started administering it to himself when he came down with cancer. And the thing that was most intriguing to me about this, and you get into about 3/4 of the way in, we didn't know why rapamycin worked. And it turns out that there's a protein in your cell that acts as a general contractor on a project, on operations within your cell. And I think it's called mTOR. And it turns out when there's plenty of nutrients in the supply chain coming to your cell doesn't take out the trash. There's a little bag, in layman's terms, inside the cell where just, you know, the little garbage men inside the cell are taking random snaps of proteins and DNA that didn't get used. And they're just packing it away in a garbage bag. And as I took away from this, the older we get, the fatter the garbage bags are. It turns out, though, that what rapamycin does is it simulates a stressful environment. It turns off mTOR. It tells mTOR, hey, there's no more resources. And the cell goes into stress mode, shutdown mode, no longer in growth mode, not subdividing. And what the cell starts to do at that point is take out the trash. So think about your body. If you're listening to this, you're probably a programmer or administrator. You've got a job. And if you want to buy a steak, you could probably buy a steak. Our bodies were not designed to have enough food all the time, according to the way this cell works. Our bodies were designed to have periods of feast and periods of famine. And during periods of famine, our bodies would clean up a little bit and take out the trash. And so it just makes me think about every time I take a bite of something now, I'm like, I'm sorry to ruin it for people. I'm like, gosh, I should stress out my body a little bit more so I can take out the trash. So there's an upside to stress. Stop eating a little bit, unless you're not healthy, then keep eating. But, you know, let your body take out the trash a little bit. You know, you don't need to always be enjoying that delicious, you know, Christmas bark or, you know, eating 3, 4, 5 times a day snacking. Just remind yourself, like, it's good for your body. you're not talking to a scientist here. I'm just a programmer. Anyways, check out this podcast. It's on Radiolab, and it's, I think, called The Dirtiest Drug.
Wow, fascinating. Well, it certainly gives a good vote for fasting occasionally. You know, my wife does, I don't know what she calls it. It's kind of a periodic fast. So she'll not eat from, you know, after dinner, like 7 o'clock, all the way through until intermittent fasting. Yeah, all the way through till like 11:30 or something. She won't have breakfast.
Yeah.
Every day. So
yeah, I've tried that too. My wife does it too. And it's sort of like, it's hard the first couple of days. I actually could, ever since I started, lunch, breakfast isn't so important. I always have coffee and I don't have sugar because I'm, you know, trying to keep the calorie intake low. I can't give my body sugar at 8 o'clock because then what's the point of fasting? Mm-hmm. You need to suppress the nutrients coming in. Mm-hmm. Who knows if intermittent fasting is actually going to be medically validated? We may find out it has, you know, it's not the latest, not the best.
Well, but it sounds like it, you know, it gives you a little opportunity to empty the trash, you know?
It does. Yeah. Take the trash out. What about you? What'd you
learn? Well, you know, I many listeners might remember that I was a foster kid and I grew up on fruit farms. Yeah. And so my parents had had bees. So we had 70 hives out front.
Whoa.
And so I've always been kind of enamored because with bees and because I just learned so much about them when I was a kid and taking
them. Have you ever pet a bee?
It's a good question. I don't know that I've pet a bee. You mentioned that, and I'll get there. You know, I will say every time I did it this morning, actually, when I dropped my kids off at school, I was walking and I saw a bee on her back on the sidewalk, right? With busy kids and stuff like that. And I cannot leave that. So I have to stop and I pick her up by the wing and I set her over somewhere where she won't get stepped on. And I do it on the pickleball court too. Bees love to come land on the court. And so I fan them off to make sure they don't, dive. So I would love to pet a bee. But I will say is like, there's a guy named Rudolf Steiner, and he was kind of an apiologist, right? Uh-huh. Someone who studies bees. This was back in probably the 1920s. And he wrote this book called The World of Bees. And he's kind of waxing philosophical on bees and kind of how they set up their society. Like, for example, he talks about how, you know, pollen is the love life of flowers and plants, because that's how they connect, right? When pollen goes to another one, that's how they reproduce. So it's like the love life of plants. And so what bees do is they go out and they essentially kind of, they take a little bit of the love life of plants without bothering the plant, right? It doesn't harm the plant in any way. And in fact, it helps the plant.
Symbiotic,
yeah. Right? So they take from the love life of plants and they bring it all back to the hive. And then through kind of their own labor of love, they produce this amazing substance with like various health qualities. And it's the only food that never spoils and all kinds of interesting things, right? And most of the bees who are doing this work are girl bees who do not reproduce themselves and have basically delegated the job of reproduction to the queen and have converted their own reproductive organs into devices for protection for the hive. And so he kind of the stinger, exactly. Oh. So that's the egg laying utility of a bee that's now been turned into a stinger. So they've kind of suppressed what, you know, Darwin and others would call that survival of the fittest and drive towards reproduction. And they've delegated it to the queen, but they're doing it as a labor of love, right? They're taking from the love life of plants and flowers, bringing it into the hive and having their own labor of love, producing honey and protecting the hive, which I just thought that's such a beautiful picture.
I think it's such a cool circle that is marvelous. It's a marvel.
Yeah.
It's a marvel that it works that way.
Yes, it is. It's really fascinating. And, you know, the other thing he highlights is that in the summer, bees will only last, they'll only live a month, you know, and even in the winter months, right, they'll maybe live 2 to 3 months at most. Yet, even with all that recycling, the personality of a hive, of this community of bees is consistent. You know, there's a very well-documented kind of anecdote that when a beekeeper dies, that the hives must be told immediately because they have a bond with the beekeeper, and that there are other beekeepers that might come and take over and they're doing the exact same thing empirically, but yet the bees don't respond. And sometimes the hives will die within a year, like just totally die out. They go and they just tell them. I don't know. I mean, he didn't mention that, but he highlights, they just go to the hives and they say, right, that he's died. And there, I'm serious, like it seems very strange, but there's this odd bondedness that the colony has with its beekeeper, even though the colony is largely being replaced every month or two.
Yeah. Cool.
Isn't that fascinating?
What book is that?
It's called The World of Bees. We'll put a link in the show notes, and it's by Rudolf Steiner. And it just has a bunch of old, I love just kind of unlocking a little bit of the world as it was, right? I feel like in our modern world with our scientific method, like we've lost the value of kind of legend and myth and kind of the epic in the sense of, you know, this like grand story. And so I just like it because he seems to tap into that a little bit and talk about, you know, the old European beekeepers of the 1700s and kind of just the way that they operated and some of
I can think of two or three people. Yep. Father's Day is coming up. I can think of two or three people who are into bees or just getting into bees, and that'd be perfect.
Yeah. So I'll put a few links up there. That's fun. Well, good. I think that kind of concludes our show for today. Please remember to subscribe, and we'd love to see your review on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, and on iHeartRadio to encourage others like you to come and join us. And if you have any ideas on things that we should have, we have new and exciting endeavors coming soon to interact more with you. But if you have any suggestions about what we'd have on the show, you can reach Eric on Twitter.
At iWell.
And you can reach me at John Kline. That's J-O-N-C-L-I-N-E. And we look forward to connecting with you. One silver lining to the current times is the ability to attend great online events that would otherwise be missed because they're not in your local area. A great example is SenCal Dreamin', coming up Tuesday, June 22nd and the 23rd from 9 to noon. It's not the full day, just the mornings on both days. Join me and other great speakers helping make the most of your Salesforce investment. It will cost only your valuable time and attention. More details at johnkline.com/CCD.